I actually want to start with a practical matter, and that is just to confirm the date for our practice session and try to clarify again exactly what I'm talking about there, what I'm imagining we will do. The idea was that, we're ending early. We're only doing seven sessions, I believe it is, instead of nine. But we will have a practice day, and the plan is to do that on December 18th. Well, actually, so December 18th is a Sunday. So what I was thinking was that December 17th would really be our practice day. And during that day, you would give as much time as you can to practice. And then also, by the end of that day, post onto the website some kind of report, some reflections or report on your practice. And then the next day, which is the Sunday, December 18th, we would meet at our usual time and just take as long as seems appropriate to talk about people's experience during the practice day and in a way kind of review what's gone on during this program. So that's the plan. I'm committing myself to it now, so I guess I had better make some notes to myself that that's what I said, but that is the idea. That's what we're planning on doing. So December 17th and 18th, please mark those dates on your calendar. Okay, so now we're ready to get started with the program for today. So you could say that there are, in a sense, I guess you could say there are three things that we're looking at as we go through this material here and try to apply it really to our lives and to the possibilities we have as human beings. That's kind of my, I guess, my catchphrase. But that's how I think about it. We limit ourselves
Say that phrase
and,
again.
excuse me?
Say that phrase again.
The possibilities we have as human beings.
Okay, thank you.
Sometimes I say the possibilities for being human, but I guess that word possibilities is one that I like because the idea here is that we have prematurely closed off, we have really limited the range of possibilities. And TSK is about opening them up again. There's a lot of things you could say. About what TSK is for, or how it works, or what it does, or the impact, or result. But that's one way of talking about it, is the possibilities, for human being or being human. So when we talk about that, there are three different dimensions, that we're really exploring and trying to see how they fit together. So one is the dimension of substance, of reality. And typically when we think about that, when we use the word substance anyway, we think about the material world because that's how we've been raised. That's the kind of materialistic bias that we have in our culture. But what I want to suggest and what I have suggested before and what seems to me to be characteristic in TSK also is that it's not only the material world that is real, that we are coming at what's real in terms of our experience. And so, yes, we really experience a world that exists outside us, and part of that world is our body. So that's part of the substantial world. But it's equally real, or what is equally real is our thoughts, our emotions, our, you could say, inner world. That's a little bit of an oversimplification, but you could say that. So Our world is partly the things we encounter in the world, and partly the ways we use a kind of natural awareness or intelligence to make sense of the world. So those are two things. And then the third thing, of course, is space. And we start from the idea that if space is opposed to substance, which is how we usually think of it, and if substance is the material world, then space is in some sense related to that material world, but it's nothing at all. It's the absence of any substance. So it's what's going on when nothing is going on, or it's what's there when nothing is there. And that's why we talk about space as being nothing at all. Now, the moment we bring in the mind realm, or our awareness or our intelligence, then the whole question of how that relates to space is very different. And that's part of what we're trying to explore, because the focus here on the mental in relation to space, I think, is part of what we're really looking at in these opening chapters. So that's kind of by way of an overview, and I keep trying to give these overviews when we start the sessions, because I think it's a very different approach, a very different understanding, and because we are reading the material very slowly, in very small chunks. That's certainly a positive thing, in as much as it gives us a chance to really think about it clearly. But the negative side of that is that we can lose track of the big picture. And so I keep trying to introduce that big picture back in. So that's why we started with a little bit of an overview. And anybody who did come in late, Kathleen is in the chat box, is talking about people who came in late. Anybody who did come in a little late can, of course, go back and take a look at this discussion, or listen to the discussion again once we get the recording up in the next couple of days. So that's the overview. Now, we were looking at the end of the last reading at this relationship between the world of our experience, or awareness, and the rest of the world. And the point that Rinpoche has been making that is really very central is that what we think of as real is manufactured or constructed or brought into being by our concerns and interests. It's not something that pre-exists us. And of course, that's a little bit, well, that's actually way far away from the way that people usually think about reality. But I don't think it's so difficult to understand or surprising or contrary to reason. It's just a different orientation. And let me say something about that, but let's do it in terms of the last paragraph on page 14, which was at the end of our reading for the previous week. So what he says is, he's talking about derivation and direction, but he's been talking in terms of the sun and the earth and the whole world, you could say, of physical reality. And he says, we can't ever really describe physical reality as a whole. He says, no description that we offer can take all these aspects into account simultaneously. Only when we settle on a particular set of concerns and understandings can we speak of derivation and direction, of going from and to, as though we were referring to a single objective truth. So what he's saying is that the reality that we name, and we usually tend to privilege the reality of substance, you know, the earth, the galaxies, the sun, the, you know, our house, our computer, all those things. The reality that we name is a result of responding to a certain set of concerns. So when we settle on a particular set of concerns and understandings, then we can kind of construct an understanding of what's real, where it comes from, where it's going, the, you know, the start, the from and the to, as he says. That's when we can come up with the idea of an objective truth. He says, whatever specifics we seize on, it is our concern and our interpretations that make them spring into being, not some solid and unmoving foundation. So the obvious objection to that, the place where people always have a little difficulty, and I'm planning now in the next minute to resolve one of the great philosophical issues. Fortunately, I don't have to rely on my own intelligence to do that. You know, Rinpoche makes it very clear. And there are other people who have, I think, really clarified this a lot. And a discussion that I've always found very interesting and helpful on this point is one that I read 20 years ago, and it's at the beginning of Heidegger's great work, Being and Time. If people would like to have the reference to that, let me know. Just email me and I'll give it to you. People usually think of Heidegger as being impossible to understand, but he's got a section where he explains all this very clearly, and it really helped me. So here's my one-minute explanation based on whatever sources I'm relying on, and I apologize if I get them wrong. The basic question is this. How can you say that what's real, what we, you know, objective truth, as he says here, how can you say that that depends on our concerns and our interpretations when the world has existed for, you know, the universe has existed for, what is it, about 13 billion years, I think they say, and the Earth has existed for maybe 6 billion. They've certainly been around a lot longer than we have. So how can you say that our concerns and interpretations are what make them spring into being, as he says? And the answer, I laugh because it's a big question, but a kind of a simple version of an answer is that when something springs into being, the nature of the being that it springs into, that is the attributes that we give to this thing that we identify as objective reality, include the attribute of having been around for 6 billion years and of being more fundamental than we are. That's the world that we construct, and it's a very helpful construction because it matches up with our experience. You know? That doesn't mean that that particular reality, that substantial reality, is more fundamental than the concerns we have that allow it to come into being. I think what I will do is post that reference, since Mark was just asking about it, the Being and Time reference. I'll post it along with the orientation. Okay. So, you know, that may or may not seem fully satisfying to you, but it's as much time as I'm going to give it right now. It just seemed to me that I ought to take it on. So we don't have to exactly resolve that right now. Because for us, what matters, and this really is actually another way of saying the same thing, although making the connection would take a little while. For us, what matters is what appears to us in our experience, the way things seem to us to be. That is the foundation. You know, if we're talking about human possibilities, the starting point is how we understand the world to be, because if we understood it differently at a very fundamental level, at the level of space and time and knowledge, to be precise, if we understood it at that level, then the range of what's possible could change. So that's where Rinpoche is is talking. And what he does in the section that we read for this week is come at that in another way. It's still the same point, but he is coming at it a little differently. And what he says is, he says, okay, we've been trying to figure out if there's some fundamental particle that really grounds reality, and it turns out that we can't really find one. But maybe there's a kind of an underlying whole. We can say, well, even if reality, even if I can't find like the atom or the quark or the subatomic particle that would really give existence to existence, and that's actually something that physics is very interested in, trying to figure that out. Even if I can't find that, there is still the sense that reality is real, that reality has some special quality which makes it different from what's not real. And that special quality, what Rinpoche calls at the top of page 15, that somethingness, must belong to the whole. And as he says here, somehow the whole of what is differentiates and specializes itself into various interacting and co-referring entities and qualities. Somehow it seeds itself into identified entities. That's a phrase worth thinking about, an identified entity, because you can see the play on words there. So Rinpoche is raising this question and trying, suggesting one more possible answer. And when he discusses that and goes on to discuss it on page 16, he links it back up to the discussion that I was just, I'm sorry, I'm noticing that some Venetian blinds are giving me a funny appearance, so I'm trying to fix that. Okay. When he's looking at this question of the wholeness as the source of reality, the sense that everything shares in some fundamental kind of essential quality, he introduces on page 16 the fundamental idea of meaning. He says, at the top of page 16, he says, when we accept something as real, we are asserting a claim about how that thing will behave across a wide range of circumstances. And that's what he means right now when he's using the word meaning. That's what he says. He says, in order for something to be real, it means something, or the whole that it's part of, has to, in some sense, be meaningful. And we want to look at that. It's kind of a narrow sense of meaning. It goes back to the idea that we talked about, we started with, that reality has to do with our concerns and interpretations. But it's a little bit more neutral than that. What he's saying really is that we can only consider something as real if it's kind of coherent with what we otherwise accept as real. So I'm going to give you an example that's, maybe not the best example, but it's the one that came to mind. So my mother-in-law, who passed away about, I don't know, maybe 8 years ago, there was a time in the years or two, a year or two before her death, where in connection with having different kinds of illnesses that sapped her strength, she would have hallucinations. She would see people, in the room. I mean, the example I'm thinking of is she would see people in the room who were old friends of hers whom she knew had died many years before. And I just remember her describing that one time. And she said, I see Sally, let's say, I see Sally sitting in the corner of the room, And she looks just as real to me as you do. But I know that she's not real because I know that she died many years ago. And so I realized that must be a hallucination. And I found that very interesting because she was really saying, you know, everything about her experience, everything about the kind of sense experience made her seem real, but it wasn't meaningful. It didn't fit into this larger picture of what counts as real. It didn't compute. And so she said, well, I know that can't be real, even though my senses are telling me that it's real. So I think that kind of thing that Rinpoche is talking about here. The whole is related to the sense of a coherency. And so from that basis, and actually want to move this along, though I'm going a little slower than I wanted to, and I do want to give some time for practice quite soon. From that sense of coherency and meaning, he starts to develop the idea of a field. And you know, the last couple of pages of this chapter are devoted to the idea of the field communique. But he first introduces the idea of a field. That's at the bottom of page 16. And he says, we are always referring things back to a more fundamental reality, right? And that more fundamental reality is the field. Our experience in this particular moment, I'm looking at the bottom of page 16, our experience in this particular moment refers back to a reality that is more than the sum of its parts. Beyond all particular interactions and all possible communications, there is the field of these interactions. This field steadily communicates its own availability as a field, together with a structure and a patterning that characterizes field operations. This is a very, very interesting and kind of original, it seems to me, approach to what constitutes reality. It's a field that communicates its own availability as a field. So let me give an example. Because you know what he's talking about here when he talks about a field is something that depends completely or in a very fundamental way anyway on our interests and concerns, and that's what we talked about earlier, right? So I was reading something yesterday, and it suggested an example to me. But you could come up with any of a bunch of different examples. So the example that this writer was using was a chair. He says, if you have a chair in your house, you could say, well, what is the field to which that chair refers back to? And as a physicist, you would have one answer to that. You would talk about molecules and atoms and matter. You would kind of talk about its existence as a material object. But let's say you were a furniture mover. Then that chair would have a very different field. It would be it would fit into the field of the things that needed to be moved. And let's say you were a guest in if someone came in as a guest in your home, they would look at the field as excuse me, at the chair as telling something, saying something about you. This is the kind of chair that you have in your house. And then, of course, there's your own perspective where it's your chair, which is very different from just being some neutral chair that you might see in a furniture store. And then you might think, let's say you were selling your chair through one of the many online ways we have of doing it now. So somebody would come and look at that chair, and they would see it in a very different field, perhaps in light of how it would fit with their furniture, right? So those are examples of fields. They may not go to the most fundamental level, but they are examples of fields that whatever we experience in this particular moment, and here we're talking about a thing, but you could also refer it to the whole range of what we experience in a particular moment. Whatever we're talking about refers back to a field which gives it meaning, right? Gives it coherence. It makes sense within that field. So let's just take a very simple example. Suppose I'm having a moving sale and I have all my belongings, including this chair, out on the lawn in front of my house, and people are coming by and deciding if they want to buy it, buy these things, and somebody asks about the chair that I'm sitting in, and I say, no, that's not for sale. I've defined the field, right? And the thing that is no longer part of the field, is not available. So the field has communicated its availability, but there's been a little ambiguity, and the person says, what about that chair? I say, no, that's not part of the field. And the whole possibility of interaction and possible communications, these are kind of simple everyday examples, and perhaps we want to go a little further, but I think they give the idea. The possible interactions, if you're having a yard sale, as we say in this country, are that somebody could put down money and buy the thing that's available for sale. But it turns out that the chair I'm sitting in is not part of that field, right? And the field, which is communicating its own availability and setting out structures and patterns, just doesn't include that. So that's kind of the idea of the field. And I think we've already moved to a very important point, which is that part of the field is this quality of communication, right? And that's really, really central. It's really important that, Rinpoche is not saying there's this reality that's a field. That would be another way of stating this idea that he began to explore that we were looking at, which is that we can refer everything in our experience back to the whole. And you can say, okay, so there's the field of all the possible things, and then you could take it one step further and say, well, there's a field that's more fundamental than all possible things. It's the one that communicates the availability, its own availability, and the availability for interaction of everything that's in the field. That's moving in the right direction. But what Rinpoche is saying is that the field itself is itself part of what's communicated, that what's fundamental is the communication. And that's why he talks about the field communique. So what really matters is not the field, but the communication that the field, it's hard to say this the right way. It's the communication that the field makes available, but there isn't a field there that communicates. It's just the communication. It's just the communication. And that's actually just another way of saying what we started off with today, which is that it's our concerns and interests that really create what is substantial for us. It's not some underlying substance. What he's really doing, you could say, is shifting the commitment to substance, which would make space nothing. He's shifting that commitment to substance to a very different commitment, which is the commitment that we always make to our own sets of concerns and interests. Okay, somebody, okay. David writes, the yard sale field included the non-inclusion of the chair you were sitting in. Well, I suppose that's true. Oh, geez, that would take me in a very different direction. To what extent does naming something as real involve excluding everything that you haven't named? That's a subject I happen to have been reading about lately, and I just can't possibly go there. But your point is right. So maybe the example, would need to be worked with a little bit to think about that. But I want to stay with this idea that the communication, the field communique, is the fundamental element, and that it's related to this idea that it's our concerns that are fundamental, and that that in turn means that this distinction that we make between substance and space is not helpful. You know, when we come in at this level, when we're trying to understand what's going on, the fundamental thing that's going on is you could say the field communique. And of course the word fundamental makes it sound again like we're looking for something that's underlying it all, but that's not exactly right. So this is like an example that you know I use all the time and that other people use, but maybe not quite in this language. If you're watching a movie, the fundamental reality that's being communicated is the images on the screen. That's the communique, right? And it is more fundamental than anything that shows up on the screen, even though of course our attention goes automatically to all the things that show up, all the figures, and you know the dialogue shows up on the screen. We're not trying to be very precise here. All of those things show up, but you know the reality of the situation is that you're watching a movie. So Michael is asking, does the communication involve more than what our concerns allow us to receive? Well, it's an interesting question. It seems to me, on the one hand, you'd say yes. I mean, ordinarily, the reality is exactly shaped by our concerns. Once you recognize that, then you realize that you could change the communique, let's say. You could change the communication, and you could possibly change it in a direction different from our ordinary sets of concerns, which limit what we can do. And that is a part of what I think ultimately the shift that we're looking at here makes possible. You can allow for different possibilities that are not so focused on the self. And space allows for that. I think it's a little premature to talk about that. But for those of you, and a lot of you are familiar with the TSK vision, I'd say that what we're talking about there is something like the second level of space and time and knowledge, where everything that you thought was real at the first level can be shifted, can be changed. But the notion of the communique, that what is fundamental, or you know what is more real, let's say, than any fundament, anything grounding, that goes more to the you could say the third level of the TSK vision, because it's showing you that you know what we understand to be space and the possibilities that space allow, and the same of course for time and knowledge, that those just don't at all have the quality or the nature that we think they do. But yes, there is a possibility once we recognize the field communique as what's going on. There's a possibility for changing that. So it's a little bit, if you stay with the image of the movie, you can say, well, it's always possible to project a different movie. Right. But yeah, okay, let me stop there. So this actually is related to a point I wanted to raise that I then want to use to get into practice, at least for a couple of minutes. So let me make this point very quickly. At the very bottom of page 17, he talks about the mutual presenting, right? He says he has just said, the whole sustains the identity of each particular part, while each part in turn confirms the manifested whole. So if we go back to the example of the yard sale, you know, somebody's driving by and they say, oh, look, a yard sale. And the fact that there's all these items out on the lawn are what communicate that there's a yard sale going on. But you could say, well, what makes it into a yard sale is if there's this item and this item and this item and this item, you look at them all as a whole, and what's communicated is yard sale. So that's kind of the example he's given. And then he says, this mutual presenting of the whole and the part, you could say, serves the purpose of the present present. Each specific juncture is authenticated identified as the real object of an authentic perception. But I just want to focus for a moment on the idea of the present present. So that is not a typo. You know, somebody might say, oh, look, they just duplicated the word. But of course, that's not the case. It's a play on words. But what Rinpoche is saying is that the field communique is a present presenting. That's what's presenting itself. In any given moment, there is a communique, and that's what presents itself, and that's what creates the present. But it's the present present, and the reason that I'm emphasizing that is that it could change in the next moment. And this is something that is so important in terms of our experience. And we all know this, of course, from, you know, people who meditate know it, but even if you don't meditate, you only have to think about it for a moment, and you know that it's the case. Once we're looking at what's being communicated, we realize that what's communicated in one moment, in one present, can be completely different from what's communicated in the next moment. And why is that? Well, you could say it's because our concerns shift. And why do our concerns shift? Well, that becomes a little bit mysterious, actually, because, you know, what happens is that the present, the content, what's being communicated in any moment, changes, you know, for no particular reason that we can ordinarily see. So, you know, one moment, I mean, it's very different when we're in a class situation like this and people are more or less focused on what's happening in the class, although I'm willing to bet that all sorts of other things have been going through your experience, and if you look carefully, you would see that. But if you take a somewhat more relaxed situation, if you're just sitting quietly in a chair or walking down the street, there are so many things going on in experience. The present present is constantly in a state of shifting. Shifting. Our concerns are constantly shifting. And if you say, why is that? That's a little hard to answer. It's a very important and interesting question. We don't need to resolve it right now. It's just good to notice that it's happening. So that's the practice, and we're running a little late, but I'd like to take at least a couple of minutes to deal with this practice, and then we'll have a couple of minutes maybe to post, you know, to ask some questions. The practice is just to be aware of what's being communicated. What is the field communique right now? And as you notice it, just see if you can get a sense of it as a field right now. And then if it shifts, and if you, you know, kind of relax and let the mind do whatever it does, it will shift. Notice that. Notice this, how the field communique communicates the present present. It always communicates the present present, but if you step back, what's present in this present is not what's present in the next present. So those are the two things to look at. One is how what's communicated is a field, a meaningful field, a coherent field that grows out of our concerns and interests. And the other is how that shifts. So let's look at that for a couple of minutes. Okay, let's stop there and see if people have any comments or reactions. I think the point is pretty straightforward. I hope so, or at least I hope we've laid out enough background for it to be pretty straightforward. But as an experiential reality, it's something that is really well worth exploring and continuing to explore, and that's what I'm going to suggest we do during the coming week. So I'm going to give people a chance to say something or type something. Hear a typist. Usually I don't hear the typing, but I guess someone has their microphone on. Okay. So Mark says the subjective map seems to be what is changing. Yeah, that's right. You could certainly say that. But that way of saying it would then presuppose that there's some objective reality. And that's one way of describing things. That's what we talked about earlier. When I suggested looking at what Heidegger has to say. But it's not the way that I think is going to be very helpful for us here. You know, my suggestion then was that this distinction into subjective and objective, if you put it in the terms that we're looking at now, you'd say that is itself a communique that says, well, I have a subjective map that I use to make sense out of an objective reality. That is a communication about the way things are. It's one possible communication. Absolutely. Anybody else?
It seems as though subject and object synthesize in experience, that experience seems to bring together a primary, what seems to be a primary duality.
So, okay, so experience is a synthesis of what seems to be this primary duality of subject and object. Sure, I'll go with that. The question is, you know, where does this structure of subject and object come from? We don't necessarily have to undermine that. We don't have to find ourselves living in a world in which that duality has somehow been erased. But it may be, and I think this is in fact where, you know, Rinpoche wants to go with this understanding, it may be that that distinction turns out not to have the solidity that we think it does. It's because we think of it as solid that we wind up setting these limits. You know, we sort of confine ourselves into our subjective reality, and then there's only a certain number of things we can do. I don't mean physically do, that may be part of it, but there's only a certain number of ways we can relate to the world and relate to our experience, and they will all be based on our own sets of concerns and interests, as we've been discussing. All of that is what we want to call into question. So yeah, there's a duality that is characteristic of our experience. It's very fundamental. The same book that I was looking at yesterday that gave the example of a chair, which we wound up, you know, I think taking in some interesting directions. But he also says, you know, Newton and Descartes were contemporaries more or less. And he says Newton's version of reality, his understanding, was wrong. But for more than 200 years, it guided people in very fruitful ways. A lot of positive things came out of it. He says Descartes' understanding, which was very much based on a very sharp dualism between subject and object, was also wrong. That was his argument. And he said He said, but after the first, within a very short time, people stopped accepting Descartes' duality. And he said, now, what would it have been like if, even though Descartes was wrong, we had kind of kept his version of reality, which matches up so much better with our ordinary intuitive understanding of a duality between the subjective and object? What would the world have been like? Would it have seemed like a more accommodating universe? Would it have changed things? Well, that's all speculation. But that kind of distinction between a kind of intuitive understanding of the duality between subject and object and staying with that, and then trying to figure out what that actually means or what possibilities open up if we don't accept it. That's the question. Okay, there have been several more comments. Let's just look at these and then we'll stop for today because we've definitely run over. Okay, so Bruce is commenting on his experience, and he says he did experience his experience as being field-like. Okay, but what stood forth had the capacity to surprise me and draw in my interest. It exceeded my presently felt interests. So he says he was surprised by the field. Well, that's interesting. So it's a field that communicates the possibility of going beyond. Maybe you could put it that way. I'm going to kind of, I think that's what Bruce is saying. I hope I got it right, Bruce. And he's not sure why the field presented itself that way. I think that's great. That kind of exploration, understanding what does the field communicate, what does it allow for? Those are exactly the kinds of questions we want to ask. And Michael says, that he was struck by the sense of how everything fits into the field just in the first moment. So yeah, I'm sitting here and there's a certain amount of traffic outside. There's horns and things like that. And when I hear those, they are already part of a field. I think that that really is part of the whole notion that a field is being communicated and that the part, the thing we identify is shaped by the field and the field is shaped by what we identify. And Karin Tomak Loza, I don't know why I gave your full name, Karin. Karin says, I wonder how the shift come into being. Is it directed or not? It seems to be by accident somehow, and Bruce agrees. And that is a fundamentally interesting question, it seems to me. We seem to have no idea. I'm struck by that in meditation sometimes, that when the mind relaxes, one of the things that often happens, at least for a while, is that there's a whole series of images, and the images seem to come from nowhere at all. And I generally find them to be quite beautiful and interesting, but I have no idea where they come from. And that's quite surprising. The mind is constantly generating one field after another, you could say, one present after another. And that is so surprising and interesting and beautiful, but also suggests that, there must be something that at a very fundamental level we do not understand. So, recognizing that we do not understand is always a good way to end a session.